This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa, and thank you for joining us. I'm Yehia Suhib in Washington, and here is what's coming up on Africa News Tonight.
We are seeing the potential now today that Cyril may want to be able to use state power, more especially the state security agencies, perhaps even to keep himself in power.
That's South African security analyst Sandile Swana on President Cyril Ramaphosa's cabinet reshuffle, specifically shifting responsibility of the intelligence agencies to his office. Details coming up. Also, Zimbabwe today remembers its heroes, the ones who fought for independence against oppressive white minority rule. These stories and more on Africa News Tonight. We start with our top story. Tunisia's powerful UGTT trade union body has urged President Kais Saied to form a new government nearly 2 weeks after he assumed executive power and sacked the prime minister. The UGTT, which played a key role in the 2011 Arab Spring uprising, said Saied had acted in accordance with the constitution, and the union agrees with his call to rethink Tunisia's political system. Mahmadia Hamami, an independent researcher and analyst who also has been a parliamentary assistant in the National Constituent Assembly, explained to VOA senior analyst Mohamed Al-Shenawi the political thinking of Kais Saied.
I tried to follow Kais Saied at least aside from the last months before the election of 2019. And I think the only way to understand some of his ideas, and I'm not saying here that he is necessarily coherent, is to go back to his first political statements and declaration that he made starting from the revolution on the eve of the election of the National Constituent Assembly. We can find several videos where he explained his rejection of the post-2011 process. He disagrees with the way the Ben Ashour Commission that was in charge of the drafting of the electoral law somehow prepared the organization of the election by giving the priority to political parties. So he stands against a system where the basic entity is a political party, and this idea is becoming more and more popular. So he considers them mostly as anti-revolutionary, as tools of power grabbing, as political machines that give access to some phony candidates who are not necessarily revolutionary, give them access to power, or simply he alluded to some political parties who are mostly interested in having access to the presidency. So this is the kind of idea that we have. So in addition to this, to his opposition to political parties, he is inspired from councilism, which is an idea that was at some moment marginally popular among some leftist organizations in Europe. It's not that prevailing anywhere in the world right now, except maybe in his circles, who shares this kind of views of necessity to radically decentralize. They seem nice. They are incoherent with his rejection of ideas from overseas. Maybe decolonial rhetoric, but in reality, he's actually taking a lot from Western thought, not necessarily mainstream ones.
So the big question is President Saied really intending to push for the implementation of an alternative political system, starting with maybe amending or changing the Tunisian constitution?
We don't know. He may change his views in the middle of the road. That's a possibility. He may start by trying to change the electoral law to make it exclude political parties. He wants to organize elections on individual-based lists and not party-based lists. He mentioned more than once, including after his election, that he wants to amend the constitution. He was explicit about it, even in the anniversary of the revolution in Sidi Bouzid in 2020, shortly after his election. So he may try to do that, but that's also a very risky, adventurous journey that we're not sure that we have a critical level of support for this kind of project. And even if he starts this journey, it's not guaranteed that we will land in a safe era. Maybe the process in which he wants to engage would break in the middle, and we find ourselves with a different type of regime, maybe an extra super presidential system similar to the one we used to have. It's not clear. So I think he's taking too much risk. So regarding your last question on the measure that should be taken to maybe change the political system, I think we didn't even try to implement ours, the one that was chosen in 2014. We don't have a constitutional court yet. We couldn't elect and implement the several independent constitutional institutions that play the role of counterbalance to corrupt businesses like the new anti-corruption organization, or that guarantees the rights of future generation. So I think on paper, the current constitution is great. Taking the risk to change it to something else is not necessarily guaranteed. And also we should keep in mind that almost 11 years after the adoption of Tunisia's first post-independence election, Bourguiba himself started attacking his own constitution, and he passed constitutional reforms to even concentrate power and to remain president for life. So reforms to constitutions are not necessarily the solution.
That was Mohamed Dia Hamami, an independent researcher and analyst, speaking with my colleague Mohamed El-Shenawi. The South African Development Community, SADC, says it will deploy a virtual mission to observe Zambia's national elections Thursday. Botswana, as the chair for the SADC organ on the politics, defense and security, will head the virtual mission, but analysts are concerned the absence of observers on the ground could compromise the monitoring process. From Abrone, Botswana, reporter Mukandisi Dube has the details.
In a statement, SADC says COVID-19 restrictions meant deploying a physical mission to Zambia was not possible. Instead, the 16-member grouping has assigned a delegation to virtually observe the elections. The mission is drawn from three countries, Botswana, South Africa and Zimbabwe, which make up the SADC organ Troika. Botswana's Minister of Foreign Affairs, Lemogang Kwabe, heads the observer mission. Previously, Kwabe said SADC was not in a position to physically deploy election observers within member states due to COVID-19 restrictions.
The regional scenario and travel restrictions and the need to safeguard public health have negatively affected the region's ability to physically deploy electoral observation missions in a conventional manner. Nonetheless, to uphold democratic principles, SADC will hold virtual consultation with electoral stakeholders and closely follow up the electoral processes. This approach is part of our continued effort towards upholding democratic principles despite the prevailing challenges hampering physical election observation on the ground.
According to Kwabe, SADC has held virtual consultations with key stakeholders in Zambia since last week Monday. These include the Zambian Electoral Commission, political parties, academia and civic organizations. But Lusaka-based opposition politician Nefas Ndlovu says virtual observation is ineffective.
It has proved that it's not effective. It has not helped the African people. It has not helped the SADC region. Basically, if you look at what has been happening in Zambia, there are so many concerns that have been raised by the opposition, especially the UPND, where we have been stopped from having, from conducting our meetings. They have been using the COVID-19 as a reason why we should not do our meetings. But if you look at the ruling party, they have been having big rallies, and yet nobody has been talking about it.
Zambia goes to the polls on Thursday with incumbent Edgar Lungu facing stiff challenge from opposition leader Hakainde Hichilema. In May, Zambia's Electoral Commission banned political rallies in a bid to cap the spread of COVID-19. For VOA, this is Mqondisi Dube in Haburoni, Botswana.
At least 51 people were killed when Islamist militants raided three villages in central Mali near the border with Niger, according to a regional administrator. The towns of Ouattguna, Karou, and Diawit Gouf were simultaneously attacked around 6 p.m. local time on Sunday. A note from the official seen by Reuters on Monday said houses were ransacked and burned to the ground and herds of livestock carried away. No group has claimed responsibility for the attacks in the area where Malian troops, French and European forces, and UN peacekeepers have been battling insurgents linked to the Islamic State and Al-Qaeda. Mali's army spokesman confirmed the attacks but gave no further details. Last week, South African President Cyril Ramaphosa moved responsibility for state security into his office. This came after a spate of public violence left at least 350 people dead. Looting and destruction of property followed the imprisonment of former President Jacob Zuma after he was found guilty of contempt of court for refusing to testify at an inquiry into corruption. Ramaphosa has branded the violence as attempted insurrection. Darren Taylor reports.
Dangerous and open to abuse is how critics are describing Ramaphosa's decision to centralize control over state security agencies, particularly the intelligence service.
We are seeing something that could be the emergence of a super presidency under Cyril Ramaphosa.
Security analyst Sandile Swana says the president was reacting to what was clearly an attempted coup by some of his comrades in the ruling African National Congress, or ANC.
We are seeing the potential now today that Cyril may want to be able to use state power, more especially the state security agencies, perhaps even to keep himself in power.
But former Intelligence Minister Ronnie Castrels says Ramaphosa taking more responsibility for state security is in keeping with international best practice.
Countries all over the world actually have the president with that control and the receipt of information timelessly within the presidency. It means that the full control over intelligence, director generals in the intelligence agencies, is with the president, but most important of all, that the information flow, the forewarning, which is what intelligence is all about, gets through to the president quickly and on time.
Kazrul says because Ramaphosa wasn't initially told about all the incitements unfolding on social media, there was a leadership void and the violence escalated.
The information went into the security cluster and all the problems therein between ministers bickering, saying they didn't receive the information, contradicting each other, and nothing got through to the president.
He says lives and property would have been saved if the president had realized the extent to which Zuma supporters were instigating disorder when it first began.
He would have ensured that the police, particularly, and they didn't come to the party, they were nowhere to be seen for many days, had been mobilized and were ready to deal with all eventualities.
Casual says Ramaphosa also had no choice but to remove Ayanda Glodlo as Minister of Intelligence in the wake of the violence.
This was so expected. You didn't need an intelligence agency to forewarn the country, actually. It was out on social media what was going on with the intelligence, crime intelligence as well. They just ignored it. The president doesn't get involved in social media, so there was no one to alert him.
He says, bizarrely, the unrest could be good for South Africa in that it's exposed Zuma and his backers as cancer and poison.
I think that the Zumaites are on a slippery slope. They can, in fact, still create mayhem, but they don't have the support, and we've seen this. Only 1.5 provinces actually got involved in the mayhem. The rest of the country was quiet.
But reasoning from people like Casrels isn't dampening the voices of those who watch events across Africa and elsewhere closely and know the terrible consequences of insecure leaders abusing state power. Ramaphosa, they say, is hopefully too good a man to do this, but he's not going to be president forever. For VOA News, I'm Darren Taylor in Johannesburg.
As South Africa marks National Women's Day today, a non-profit organization is gearing up to launch a business restart program for survivors of gender-based violence. The 1,000 Women Trust has been promoting the use of technology like WhatsApp groups since the lockdown started in March last year. It believes that abuse of women has increased during this period. It also estimates that around 2 million women have lost their jobs. Reporter Vicky Stark spoke to Matilda Fakazi, who runs the organization's immigrant program from Cape Town.
37-year-old Fakazi is herself a survivor of gender-based violence. She says she suffered for years at the hands of her first husband.
He broke me, like, practically in all forms of abuse, financially, physically, emotionally.
She says even though she divorced him, it affected her second marriage. She would picture her first husband when the second one touched her. Fakazi says meeting the founder of the 1,000 Women Trust, Tina Tiat, changed her life.
When I get to know Tina as a friend, I started opening up to her, and she thanked me for trauma counseling. I was helped, and I started living my life with happiness, with no regrets. It takes time to heal, but I finally found my peace.
Fakazi, who is a qualified teacher from Zimbabwe, decided to join 6,000 other women to train as a trauma counselor so she could help others. Together, they offer a dial-a-buddy system for abused women. They also run support groups in person and through WhatsApp. Fakazi heads the group for immigrants, both documented and undocumented.
So far, I've got like 1,013 women that I've been working with, and they are in different parts of South Africa, and they come from different countries. We have women from Zimbabwe, Zambia, DRC, Cameroon, Kenya, and also Mozambique.
Fakazi says their 1,000 Women Restart program will offer resources, training through webinars and Facebook, networking and mentorship. They're looking to help women start and restart businesses like spaza shops, sales of airtime, garden services and sewing.
If they don't become personally sustainable, they will still fall for abusive relationships. So the Restart program is about empowering and supporting business women. And those women are those survivors of GBV who are trying to make a living.
The organization is hosting 3 free webinars this month. Tomorrow's is on self-confidence, followed by investing in women and economic empowerment. This is Vicky Stark for Voice of America News in Cape Town.
It is Heroes Day in Zimbabwe, a time to celebrate the sacrifice of those who fought for independence against oppressive white minority rule. The sacrifice is undisputed, but critics say the view of a hero should be more inclusive, given now challenges have changed. Reporter Kuzaiza Nawashi has the details.
The day is met with mixed feelings, especially among young people. Political analyst Pride Mukono explains the significance.
Heroes Day basically reminds us that as a society we've come quite a long way in terms of the values of freedom and liberation and the shared heritage. And I think in my view, that entails that we ought to celebrate what the contribution made by the past generations, that shared heritage and that common history of seeking freedom and liberation is something that binds us like a thread throughout the history of our society.
Karen Mukwasi is a young Zimbabwean. She says the idea behind the Heroes Day has been tainted.
For a lot of Zimbabweans, this day continues to lose meaning. It has been politicized. They have completely forgotten that our grandmothers, our mothers, our fathers were in the villages. They were fighting alongside them. They would cook for them. They would alert them of any danger. They would hide them. Personally, my grandmother lost her house when her house was bombed because the liberation fighters were hiding behind her house. To me, she was a liberation war hero. She made a sacrifice.
Although those like Mukwasi's grandmother are not celebrated, critics say they were the backbone of the struggle and were exposed to persecution for helping the liberation fighters. Mukono says, fast forward to today, and the idea of heroes should evolve with the times.
as we are progressing with and our country's coming of age, it is apparent that the heroes of today are now different from the heroes of yesteryear. I still believe that today our doctors who are on the front line of fighting the coronavirus amid so many shortages and so many problems are also our heroes. We have our teachers like those in the that are educating our children in rural schools, which are under-equipped, which have nothing, and are earning a very meager salary, but still keep on ensuring that our children get education. Those are our modern-day heroes.
He adds that human rights activists like Makomborero Haruzivishe, who has been incarcerated for over 6 months, are today's heroes as they fight to secure the same freedoms that came with the liberation struggle. Despite the politicization of heroes and the declaration of national and provincial heroes, critics say the government's populist stance has seen the stance changing. The late musician Oliver Mtukudzi was declared a national hero, while another musician, Saul Musaka, widely known as Soldier Love, was declared a provincial hero when he passed on. For VOA, this is Kudzai Zinawashe from Harare.
Delta variant strain of COVID-19 is taking a toll on young people in Zimbabwe, and observers cite complacent behavior as a possible reason for its devastating effect. Arigando gives us more on the story.
The Minister of Health and Child Care has revealed that the Delta variant is accounting for 79% of infections in the country. And medical experts say the popular PCR COVID-19 nasal swab test is not adequate to detect it. They say the virus is particularly insidious because it goes straight to the lungs, registering few symptoms along its disastrous wake. Still, observers say socioeconomic factors also have a bearing in the rate of infections, with citizens in a mostly informalized economy without safety nets selling and buying goods. Authorities say many young people spend an inordinate amount of time on social media dodging vaccination while pandering to conspiracy theories. In the city of Bulawayo, for instance, authorities revealed this past week that a quarter of the deaths in the city are between the ages of 20 and 40. The former health minister, Henry Madzorera, says a sea change in behavior needs to take place among young people.
This Delta variant seems to spread much more easily than the previous variants we've had. And it seems to be attacking even the younger generation, whom we didn't see attacked in the past two waves. It is quite vicious. This is a problem. Now, to the young people, I just want to say, you must get vaccinated. Don't listen to WhatsApp rumors and other things. You are now just as vulnerable as the older generation. Don't gather in political meetings. Don't be sent on unholy missions. Just stay at home. Sanitize, wash your hands, mask up.
Meanwhile, the Bulawayo Progressive Residents Association says the so-called Vuzu illegal parties where underage youngsters consume alcohol and engage in premarital sex should be reconsidered. Tembelane Duwe of BPRIA weighs in.
The first point that people need to understand is that no one is immune from COVID-19. What we have been witnessing lately is that the younger generation is now contracting COVID-19. This new Delta variant doesn't choose. No age group is safe from the Delta variant. And most of the cases, you find that the youths are the ones who are a bit reckless. They conduct parties. They have a tendency of walking around the streets without putting on masks. They are the most mobile group. And at the same time, they are the partying group in terms of attending illegal parties. So as a residents association, we would like to urge the younger generation, especially those who are of school going age, those of college age, must take care. They must mask up. They must stay at home.
Others say COVID-19 restrictions that suspended in-person classes have left many youngsters restless and indulging in reckless behavior. Reporting for VOA, this is Adigondo in Bulawayo, Zimbabwe.
That wraps up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Yehiyas Wuhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voanews.com. On behalf of our producer, Mokbilia Baro, thank you again for tuning in and choosing the Voice of America.